If you're an RIA or looking to become one, Schwab Advisor Services is the Watson to your homes. Smart, dependable, always has your back. It's no mystery why they're the number one choice for RIAs who want to be the ultimate solution for their clients. With all the wealth services, technology, and support your firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Follow the clues at schwabvious.com.
November 19th. It's, for most people, just another Tuesday.
Right.
But if you go back 160-some years, November 19th, 1863, that was the day of the Gettysburg Address, a moment defined by this huge fundamental conflict over what America even was.
And that's such a good frame for the sources you've sent over, because you can see these echoes of that same structural battle today. It's just, you know, it's masked by all this high-stakes political drama.
Okay.
So I think for this deep dive, our mission is to sort of untangle three big areas. We've got this political surrender on the Epstein files.
Uh-huh.
Then there's this really transactional deal-making with the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
And the big one.
And the big one, yeah. The foundational fight over gerrymandering, sort of an arms race.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start with what was probably the biggest domestic headline, the House vote on the Epstein materials.
Yeah.
The whole story just shifted so fast from if the administration would block it to, why they suddenly just folded.
The initial vote was, I mean, it was almost unprecedented. You had 534 members of Congress.
Wow.
A near unanimous vote to demand the release of these files. That kind of unity, you know, against a sitting administration. It's a huge signal of institutional pressure.
And yet there was one single no vote. Representative Clay Higgins from Louisiana. Why? Why him? Why stand alone?
Well, Higgins gave a really detailed reason. He argued the bill, and this is a quote, abandons 250 years of criminal justice procedure in America.
How so?
His point was that you're forcing the release of files from an ongoing investigation. And he claimed that doing that risks injuring, you know, thousands of innocent people, witnesses, family members, people who just provided alibis by making all their confidential info public.
So his argument is all about process, about protecting innocent bystanders.
Exactly. But of course, the sources immediately jump to the political angle.
Sure.
They're suggesting he's either, you know, positioning himself as a loyalist to the former president, or he's basically laying the groundwork, the legal argument, for them to hide the files later.
And what's so fascinating is how the Senate handled it. It gets over there, and the minority leader, Chuck Schumer, pushes it through with unanimous consent.
Yeah, can you just break that down for a second? Why is that move so important here?
It's a procedural shortcut, really. It lets a bill pass without a formal roll call vote, as long as no single senator objects.
So it's fast.
It's fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it lets every single senator avoid having to go on the record. You know, taking a politically risky vote on something this explosive, mm-hmm. it's the clean way to apply maximum pressure with minimum personal risk.
And the pressure clearly worked, because then we see this complete reversal from the former president. One minute he's fighting the release, the next he's publicly supporting the bill.
Right. And this pivot, the sudden surrender, kicked off a bunch of theories in the source material trying to explain what happened.
Yeah, and the theories are really telling. One is purely strategic. They call it the Ukraine playbook.
Okay.
The idea is, if bad stuff is coming out anyway, you release it yourself. You control the narrative.
And then you tell your base it was a perfect move all along.
Exactly. You gaslight them.
But does the administration really have the discipline for that? I mean, their crisis management hasn't always been sharp.
It hasn't.
Yeah.
Which is why the other theory, the one based on psychology, feels a little stronger.
The idea that he just can't stand to look like a loser.
Right. Psychologically, he's just incapable of admitting he lost a fight. So if he can't stop it, he has to pretend it was his idea the whole time.
So those theories explain the public pivot. But the consensus in the sources seems to be that this is all just a setup for a concealment strategy.
That's it. They're just buying time and changing the battlefield.
Yeah.
And there are two main ways they could try to hide the information.
Okay, what's the first?
The attorney general could just claim the files are part of an ongoing investigation that legally shields them. It's basically the new my taxes are under audit excuse.
And the second way involves Congress itself, using that same argument from the one dissenting vote.
That's the more subtle play. Once Congress has the files, members aligned with the administration can just start quoting Clay Higgins. We have to protect the innocent witnesses, the families.
So they can justify redacting huge chunks of it.
Huge chunks. And the big win for transparency becomes, you know, an empty gesture. They give you a stack of blacked out pages.
Okay, so let's shift from domestic pressure to these high stakes foreign deals. The recent White House meeting with Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
Yeah, MBS.
They pulled out all the stops for him. I mean, Marine Corps band, an F-35 flyover, the whole nine yards.
The ceremony really matched the prize thereafter. The whole visit was about a massive transactional arms deal, selling 300 American tanks and, crucially, F-35s to Saudi Arabia.
And this is where the sources get really critical. The deal was made with, and I'm quoting here, no strings attached.
Which is just malpractice diplomatically. You would think a skilled negotiator would use those F-35s as leverage.
Right. To push Saudi Arabia to normalize relations with Israel, that's a huge U.S. priority in the region.
But that condition was just gone, not even on the table. And on top of that, the former president gave MBS these huge political gifts.
You're talking about Jamal Khashoggi.
He publicly defended MBS over the murder of Khashoggi, which, remember, the CIA says MBS ordered, and he's out there saying MBS knew nothing about it. He even called Khashoggi extremely controversial.
And he didn't stop there. He also suggested the Saudi government had nothing to do with 9/11.
A claim that just flies in the face of, you know, two decades of evidence.
So after giving away all that leverage, all that political cover, what did the U.S. actually get in return?
A massive, almost laughably huge financial promise.
Yeah.
MBS said he would up his investment in the U.S. from $600 billion to $1 trillion.
A trillion.
Except just pause on that number. Saudi Arabia's entire annual GDP is only about $1.2 trillion. The idea that they're investing nearly their entire country's output, it's a rhetorical tool, not a real number.
So even if we take a more realistic number, say $300 billion over a decade, the term investment itself can be tricky, right? It's not necessarily building factories here.
Oh, it could be the exact opposite. The sources warn that MBS could use that money to buy controlling shares in strategic American companies. Think chip manufacturers, or even an iconic brand like Ford.
And once they have a controlling interest,
their people are on the board. They can change priorities. They can push to move R&D offshore, force the company to share trade secrets. It's basically a legal way to gut American industries from the inside.
It is transactional foreign policy at its most raw. But the sources all point to one truly concrete, undeniable win, and it was for the family.
Absolutely. The focus snaps right to the $2 billion investment fund that the Saudis gave to the former son-in-law, Jared Kushner.
Right.
And from MBS's perspective, this is a brilliant, low-cost investment. He pays what is, to him, a pittance, these exorbitant management fees, and in return, he gets influence and access. That $2 billion fund, that's framed as a real win for the family.
Let's pivot now to the structural foundation of our democracy, gerrymandering. And we can start with a really surprising lesson out of California, Proposition 50.
Yeah, that 64 to 36% vote is so telling. It really suggests that for Democratic voters, playing fair is not the top priority anymore.
They just want to win.
They want to win any way that is legal. And that feeling, that shift, is putting enormous pressure on Democratic leaders to just abandon unilateral disarmament in these map-making wars.
And this puts a huge target on states where Democrats have total control. All eyes are on Governor J.B. Pritzker in Illinois.
Right, because Illinois is a Democratic trifecta. Yeah. They have the governor's office and supermajorities in the legislature.
Yeah.
And this is key. They do not have an independent commission.
So Pritzker legally has the power to draw whatever map he wants.
And he's positioned to set this new hyper-aggressive standard. The threat is that he could draw a map that eliminates all three Republican districts in the state. Imagine him bragging that he created a zero Republican delegation.
But ironically, as Democrats are gearing up to go on offense, the Republican side of this arms race has been hitting some major roadblocks.
That's right. In Kansas and Indiana, for example, their efforts to draw these super GOP-friendly maps just stalled.
Not because of a court challenge?
No, because of fear of the voters. Legislators were afraid that if they drew maps that were too obviously partisan, their own voters would punish them at the polls. They got scared of their own shadows.
And the news was even worse for the GOP in Utah.
Much worse.
Yeah.
A judge just flat out threw out their map.
Yeah.
And the new court-ordered map creates a heavily Democratic district. D plus 24. Former Congressman Ben McAdams is running there. That looks like a guaranteed GOP seat loss.
But the biggest blow, the real bombshell, came out of Texas. That was supposed to be the crown jewel of their redistricting effort.
Absolutely. A three-judge panel blocked their new map, the one that was designed to create five new Republican seats. The court said it was racially discriminatory.
And they forced Texas to use the old 2021 map for the next election, so the GOP gets zero new seats for all that effort.
But the wildest detail is about the Department of Justice. The court's opinion actually cited a letter from the current administration's DOJ. But then, in the same opinion, they ripped that letter to shreds, calling it legally unsound and a mess. So you have this bizarre situation of a court ruling against a Republican map while also kneecapping the Democratic administration's legal argument. It's just a massive setback for the GOP.
And this whole debate always comes back to the solution that, you know, 77% of voters say they want independent commissions.
But as you said, the devil is always in the details of how you structure that commission.
Right.
If you look at California, their model is really hard to game because it focuses on getting partisans out of the selection process itself. They use a panel of state auditors and have strict rules, like no partisan activity for 10 years.
And Colorado has a different kind of safeguard, right? To force consensus.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Their commission has 12 members, and you need 8 votes to approve any map. But here's the key. 2 of those 8 votes must come from the independent members. It forces the two parties to actually negotiate and find a middle ground.
So let's talk scale for a second. Based on the sources, what would actually happen if blue states just go all in on this arms race? Follow the Pritzker model.
The potential gains are just enormous. If you look at the states where Democrats already have a trifecta, they could potentially pick up 25 seats total. California alone is a 9-seat prize.
And the real prizes are the swing states where Democrats might win a trifecta soon. Arizona, North Carolina, Pennsylvania.
Those 3 states alone could be another 29 seats. And the level of detail they're going into it's surgical. We saw data for one hypothetical district in North Carolina where the difference came down to a single registered Democrat versus a single registered Republican.
Just incredible.
That's the level of this fight now.
Which brings us back one last time to November 19th, 1863, to Gettysburg.
Right.
The ceremony itself was delayed until that date so the main speaker, Edward Everett, could finish his research for what turned out to be a 2-hour speech.
And Lincoln was, you know, almost an afterthought. He was just invited to give a few appropriate remarks. But in 2 minutes, he completely redefined the entire American project.
Starting with that first line, 47 years ago, by dating the country to the Declaration of Independence, not the Constitution.
He completely shifts the focus because the Constitution at that point protected slavery. It counted enslaved people as 3/5 of a person.
But the Declaration.
The Declaration defined the nation on the proposition that all men are created equal. So Lincoln reframes the war. It's not just about saving the Union anymore. It's a battle to redefine the nation around that idea of equality.
And he calls that idea a proposition, something we're testing. Testing whether a nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. He asks the living to dedicate themselves to the unfinished work.
And he ends with that vow, that the dead shall not have died in vain, that the nation will have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
That ideal feels so far away from the transactional deals and the cynical political games we've just been talking about?
It does. And yet, there's this one core finding from your source material that is so counterintuitive, it just sort of stops you in your tracks.
And what's that?
It's the idea that this current, ugly, hyper-aggressive, gerrymandering arms race, that this might be the only thing that could actually force Congress to ban the practice for good.
So it has to get worse before it gets better.
Exactly. The theory is that the spectacle of both sides engaging in this mutually destructive map drawing, you know, Pritzker eliminating every Republican in Illinois, Republicans doing the same elsewhere, it will create so much public disgust that even the partisans will be forced to support reform just to save the institution's credibility. It's like political, mutually assured destruction.
Which leaves a really provocative question for you, the listener, to think about. We've seen how partisan self-interest is just dominating everything. But if the only path to protecting government of the people, by the people, for the people, runs through an escalating retaliatory arms race, does that make this anti-democratic fight a necessary evil to achieve that new birth of freedom?